Join Kim Gattas in Beirut for a new interview show, People Like Us, a podcast connecting the dots between today's Middle East and the world, how it works and why it matters to you wherever you are. Discover the trends and themes that bring together people like us everywhere, from Beirut to Kabul to Hong Kong. So tune in every week wherever you get your podcasts and follow along on Twitter and Instagram at People Like Us Pod.
Russia keeps firing off missiles at Ukraine, but how long can the supplies last?
They can't do it every day because their inventories are limited.
We'll dig into how much stockpile Russia has left. I'm Carol Hills. Also ahead, an English museum that's using interactive displays to help people with dementia.
You know, if people are touching the screen, go, oh my God, I remember being there. Oh, this has happened. This has happened.
Plus, this is supposed to be Lionel Messi's World Cup. The Argentine soccer legend has admirers across the globe. He even has some fans rooting against their own countries.
Even though our country is against Argentina, I really want Messi to win this World Cup because football owes Messi this World Cup.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. In Indonesia, rescue workers are sorting through the rubble. More than 250 people are dead and hundreds more are missing and injured after a major earthquake yesterday. Officials are also saying that more than 22,000 homes were destroyed. The earthquake measured 5.6 magnitude on the Richter scale, which is not especially high, but the damage was severe. To help explain this, we're turning to Katrin Monica. She's an associate professor of geosciences at Wellesley College in Massachusetts. Katrin, why so much damage from not that big of a quake, at least as measured on the Richter scale?
The main cause for this strong damage is the shallowness of the earthquake. So the earthquake focus was relatively shallow, maybe around 10 kilometers below the Earth's surface. And when you have these shallow earthquakes, they just generate quite strong ground motion at the surface of the Earth.
That's interesting. Do other places on the globe have similar shallow quakes as you describe them?
Yeah. For example, you could find them right in California, similar size too. So any seismically active area could basically produce such an earthquake.
Because they're not that far from the surface of the Earth. So any kind of quake is going to really cause a lot of damage.
That's right. Yeah. The rupture basically happens very close to the Earth's surface. And then the seismic waves that are radiating out are very powerful and basically can cause a lot of damage.
Can you explain the general seismology of Indonesia? I mean, how many fault lines are there there?
Yeah, so the seismic setting basically of Indonesia is interesting. So the Earth's outer shell is divided into these plates, and these plates move relative to each other. And in Indonesia, we have the situation that two plates are basically moving against each other. And when this happens, you build up a lot of pressure, and then the pressure is released in these strong earthquakes.
Now, as I mentioned, an estimated 22,000 homes were destroyed. Lots of structures just collapsed, and they were clearly not built to withstand a major earthquake. Is it because of building and engineering standards or something else?
I would think a lot of factors could come together here. So maybe the first thing is that earthquakes, even though they're very common in Indonesia, at one or the other location, they might not occur for several decades or centuries. And so you might lose a little bit the memory of this hazard in a particular location. This is an area that is, West Java is densely populated. So I do think there were, you know, a lot of buildings. And I think the other thing is that maybe, as you mentioned already, some of these buildings might not have met the earthquake standards, basically, and collapsed very easily, basically.
You've worked in Indonesia quite a lot. What can you tell us about Indonesia's preparedness for these types of earthquakes and natural disasters?
They are really trying to be well prepared for these earthquakes, and every region does it probably slightly differently. So I would think, for example, in the aftermath of the 2004 earthquake and Indian Ocean tsunami, in the northernmost part of Indonesia, in Aceh, there was a lot of rebuilding that was done with earthquake standards in mind and for people to be able to evacuate. But maybe this is not throughout this very big nation.
If you had the ear of the Indonesian government, what would you suggest they do to live with earthquakes and be a bit safer?
I do think you need to really put everything into assessing the natural hazard. So basically assessing where can earthquakes occur, how strong they might be, and how often do they occur. And once you have that knowledge, basically, then you can say, okay, this is the largest earthquake we can expect in this location, and this is what we have to build for. And of course, this is easier said than done, because you basically, as we said already, need to do this throughout the entire nation.
Katrin Monica is an associate professor of geosciences at Wellesley College in Massachusetts, where she's been speaking to us from. Katrin, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
The Colombian government has launched peace talks with the largest remaining rebel group in the country. It's part of an effort by new President Gustavo Petro to bring total peace to Colombia. The guerrilla group is the National Liberation Army, or ELN. It's grown in influence in parts of Colombia that were abandoned by FARC rebels after a 2016 peace deal. Reporter Manuel Rueda has more.
Negotiators from both sides gave themselves a round of applause as they launched peace talks at a hotel in Caracas, Venezuela. The government's representatives said these talks are a sign that Colombia is changing.
Sentimos de que estamos en un momento histórico casi único para el país.
This is historic, and it's a unique moment for our country, said Danilo Rueda, the government's peace commissioner. We can't shy away from the responsibilities we have to future generations. The ELN was formed in 1964, and it currently has about 4,000 troops that control drug trafficking routes and illegal gold mines in parts of Colombia and Venezuela. This is the sixth time that the rebels and the Colombian government have staged peace talks, but it's the first time that the rebel group will be negotiating with a leftist government.
Realmente la diferencia hoy es que hay un gobierno progresista.
Things are different now, said ELN commander Pablo Beltran. There's a progressive government that promised during the election that they were committed to peace. But many in Colombia are skeptical about these talks and say that the ELN will be harder to disarm than the FARC rebels. Sergio Guzman is a political analyst in Bogota.
I don't think that for many reasons the negotiation is going to be successful. It's a fragmented organization. It's unclear if they have full mandate of all of the units and are able to implement whatever decision that they effectively negotiate in the table.
ELN commanders have said that they want the government to invest more in anti-poverty programs, nationalize oil, and revise Colombia's electoral system. They also want community groups in remote areas to participate in the process, which could make things more complicated. To meet international treaty obligations, the rebels will have to provide reparations to victims and serve some sort of punishment for war crimes.
They may want more lenient judicial sentences, even than the FARC obtained in their agreement. And that's going to be a very difficult item for the government to overcome.
If the ELN end up disarming, it would be a huge victory for President Gustavo Petro. He campaigned on bringing peace to rural areas of Colombia that have long been affected by drug violence and rebel groups. But Petro's government hasn't scored any military victories against the ELN that might pressure the rebels into signing a deal anytime soon. It took Colombia's government more than 4 years to sort out a peace deal with the FARC rebels. The clock is already ticking for the Petro administration, which must leave office in the summer of 2026. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda, in Bogota.
It can seem like Russian missile and drone attacks on Ukraine are coming in near constant waves, barrage after barrage, day after day. But Moscow's stockpiles are not endless. To dig into whether Russian weapon supplies are in fact dwindling and how they're replenishing them, we reached out to Mark Kansian. He's a former Pentagon official, now at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Mark, on any given day, Russia seems to be able to pummel Ukraine, raining down close to 100 missiles and drones. Are you and other weapons experts surprised at how frequent and continuous these assaults have been?
Well, not really. I think the key thing is that on any given day, they can do that, but they can't do it every day because their inventories are limited. They have fired something over 2,000 long-range missiles. It's estimated that might be sort of 30-ish percent of their inventory being left.
Do they have a way to replenish their supply of the long-range high-precision missiles?
Well, the short answer is no, at least not from domestic production. Even before the war, domestic production was very slow, something around 100 missiles a year. And now with sanctions in place, it's more difficult to get the necessary components. What they've done is they've reached out to Iran to get what are called kamikaze drones, which have the same effect. And also it's suspected they'll be acquiring long-range missiles.
How do we know that Russia has only 30% left of its high-precision missiles?
Well, the short answer is we really don't. We don't have a good handle on what their inventories are. The Ukrainians have made statements to the effect that their intelligence says that the Russians are down to about 30%. And people have been tracking this pretty closely, the launches. And we can see from the fact that the attacks are episodic that they're experiencing shortages.
If they get more high-precision missiles, who do they have to get them from? What country?
It looks like only Iran will sell them long-range precision missiles. It's not inconceivable they could get some from North Korea. North Korea is supplying artillery ammunition, and they could potentially supply missiles, but so far that's not been the case.
The kamikaze drones you mentioned that are coming from Iran, are new supplies of them constantly being sent from Iran?
It looks like they're supplying them continuously. Russia's paying for them, and Iran sees this as both an economic and a diplomatic opportunity.
Is Russia ramping up its own missile production in its own factories as a way to kind of plan?
I think they're trying to do that, but it's going to be very difficult. First, they didn't produce very many even before the war. Numbers are in the range of 100 to maybe 200 at the most. You know, that's enough for maybe 1 month of operations. And then there are the problems of sanctions, the fact that they're not able to get many of the high-tech components that certainly will slow them down. So domestic production is not going to be a solution for them.
From what you know, can Russia just kind of keep on going and it has enough alternative supply sources to keep this war going with the kamikaze drones and high-precision missiles? Or are they going to run out?
They can probably keep going for quite a while. Also, these are not critical to their success on the battlefield. They're mostly used for attacks on rear areas. They have been attacking Ukrainian, like the electrical grid, and having some success there. But the war is going to be decided on the front lines with the troops there and the capabilities there.
When all is said and done, is this war essentially a race to see whether Russia or Ukraine's Western allies can ramp up production of war materials more quickly, or is it something else?
It's more like a marathon, and the pacing element may well be artillery ammunition. The Ukrainians are firing something on the order of 5,000 a day. The Russians are firing even more on the order of 10,000 a day. When you look at the front lines, when front lines stabilize in a conflict, that's when artillery becomes the primary weapon. We're seeing that in Ukraine now. It looks a lot like World War I with 21st century weapons. So heavy artillery fires is part of Russian doctrine. It's been part of Russian doctrine for a century. And if they can keep it up, that might help them hang on. If they can't keep that up, that will give Ukraine an opening to continue its offensives. There's also an irony here, which is that the North Koreans are supplying artillery ammunition to the Russians. The South Koreans are providing artillery ammunition to the Ukrainians through the United States. So the two Koreas are having a proxy war 8,000 miles away.
That's amazing. Retired Colonel Mark Kansian is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and he's a former Defense Department official. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Historical images and sounds can spur nostalgia, and for people with dementia, that immersion in the past can be powerful. That story is just ahead. You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Across the globe, more than 55 million people live with dementia. According to the World Health Organization, there is currently no cure. But museums around the world are stepping in to do their part. The World's Bianca Hillier has our story.
Upon entering the On the Road Museum in Liverpool, visitors are quickly transported to a time long ago. You can hear a carter's wagon from the 1950s, smell the pungent aroma of carbolic soap, and see the city's overhead railway from the early 20th century.
We wanted it to be as immersive as possible.
Carol Rogers is the director of House of Memories, which runs On the Road. The museum, which is mobile and housed in a 320-square-foot bright pink trailer, was designed for people living with dementia and their caretakers. The goal is to evoke memories from people's childhoods by seeing different stimulants and touching the interactive walls. Jackie Quirk has walked through the museum with dementia patients she cares for.
You know, if people are touching the screen and go, oh my God, I remember being there. Oh, this has happened. This has happened.
Quirk says she's seen this time spent reminiscing on fond memories positively impacting the rest of people's day.
You can tell they've had such a good day because you can see a smile on somebody's face.
The On the Road experience is also available through a free app called My House of Memories. Users can click through images and hear sounds to jog their memory. In the UK, the sounds of the cinema may bring people back to their teenage years, while in Singapore, the simple sound of marbles rolling on wood could remind them of Chongkak, a children's board game. But it's not all in the name of entertainment. Roger says eliciting people's long-term memories has an important practical role.
It allows care providers to find the person beyond the dementia diagnosis because there will be things revealed about their heritage and life story that helps the carer in their everyday interactions with the person living with dementia.
Lynn Howarth from the University of Toronto has studied how people with early stage Alzheimer's, a disease that leads to dementia, use tangible mementos to recall life stories.
In an odd sort of way, it's more beneficial to the family member or the friend or the person working with the individual than those who are dealing with cognitive decline.
The On the Road Mobile Museum is part of a global trend of museums, care homes, and libraries curating experiences for people with dementia. Initiatives have popped up in Australia, the U.S., and throughout the U.K. Margaret Sewell helped create one of the first at New York's Museum of Modern Art. She's an associate professor of psychiatry at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Sewell says, understandably, there's been a lot of focus on finding a cure for Alzheimer's disease. These programs don't claim to do that.
They're not about, quote, improving memory, per se. I wish they were able to do that.
Still, she says that doesn't mean they're any less valuable.
These programs have been shown to improve mood and decrease agitation, which are enormous issues for people dealing with dementia and for the people who care for them.
Sewell says she hopes to see museums continuing to invest in these kinds of programs. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The West African nation of Mali is taking further steps to distance itself from France, its one-time colonizer. The government of Mali said it will no longer accept aid from French NGOs or groups that are funded by France. For the past decade, France has provided about 100 million euros in assistance. The new announcement is raising fears about what this could mean for the hundreds of thousands of Malians who rely on that aid. Daniel Eisenga is a research fellow at the African Center for Security Studies, and he's been following the situation in Mali closely. Daniel, first of all, for those of us who aren't following Mali as closely as you, who is in charge there now?
In August 2020, there was a military coup. A group of five colonels took power. But then in May 2021, they staged a sort of second coup, a coup within a coup. And these same colonels pushed out all of the civilians, essentially, from that transition. Presently, Colonel Assimi Goïta is the president of Mali. He's surrounded himself with coup supporters, and they've really been calling the shots without any checks on their power since May 2021.
So why is this current government in Mali trying to distance itself from France?
They've really pursued a populist narrative that has leaned into sort of anti-French sentiment within the capital city of Bamako. They've done this by stoking, you know, anti-imperialist messages, by blaming France for insecurity. Mali has been facing militant Islamist violence since 2012. And every single year that France has been there, it's gotten worse. They had a few thousand French soldiers who were stationed in Mali at several bases across the country. And so the Malian junta has really tried to stick the buck with France.
French President Emmanuel Macron said yesterday that essentially the door is open in Mali for Russia to now muscle in. What does he mean by that?
With the junta pressuring France to leave, Macron decided to withdraw all French troops from Malian territory. And the junta has aligned itself with Russian mercenaries, particularly the shadowy organization, the Wagner Group. But one of the main things that they've done is provide sort of a buffer for the junta. So they've made it very difficult to attack Bamako and to go after the junta itself. But they're really a political tool. They haven't done very much to address the insecurity that's been running rampant across the country. We're estimating that in 2022, we're going to see at least an increase of 33% in terms of the number of violent events. And that's already on top of a record-breaking year in 2021.
Has the Wagner Group had any luck against the Islamic insurgency in Mali?
So the Wagner Group's MO is not one of creating security for civilians. It's one of going after communities in a way in which they violate many different human rights. And so we've seen massacres of villages on market days where more than 300 people were killed. And the justification is that these were violent extremists. But the reality is that there's nowhere in Mali where you have 300 or 400 violent extremists gathering in one place. We're talking about militant Islamist groups that comprise a few thousand fighters at most.
Circling back to French President Emmanuel Macron, what about his remarks struck you as the most interesting?
Well, I think Emmanuel Macron is doing his very best to try and push back against Russia on the communications scene. What we've seen that Russia has been really effective at within West Africa has been the asymmetric tactics of disinformation. The Wagner Group and Russia has really put into the social media environment a message of Wagner's here to help. And that circulates in places like the capital city in Bamako. Russia is trying to gain a foothold in Mali, but it's not doing so to secure Mali for Malian citizens. It's doing so so that it can win over the cronies that are in the Malian junta and gain some greater access to resources and other valuable commodities in Mali.
Daniel Eisenga is a research fellow at the African Center for Security Studies. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you, Carol. Great to be with you.
You're with the world. One word is helping archaeologists in Spain solve a centuries-old mystery.
Sorion Eku.
Sorion Eku, or good fortune. Proof that the written Basque language is a whole lot older than linguists thought. How archaeologists crack the code, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Just in case you're not following the World Cup, a shocking moment earlier today. The announcer saying, God, God, God in Arabic after Saudi Arabia took a 2-1 lead over soccer powerhouse Argentina. The score held and the Saudis won. An historic moment of triumph for Saudi Arabia. An historic moment of despair for Argentina. The South American soccer dynamo came in as one of the favorites to win this World Cup. Now it faces an uphill battle just to qualify for the next round. The team is powered by global superstar Lionel Messi. He's now 35, and this may be his last chance to capture the one soccer honor that's eluded him. Reporter Alain Ruiz Tarol has this profile of Messi from Barcelona, where the soccer icon spent most of his career.
On a summer night, 17 years ago, my father took me to see a soccer game at Camp Nou, FC Barcelona Stadium. On the pitch, wearing the Barcelona red and blue shirt, was a skinny 18-year-old with long, shaggy hair. His name was Lionel Messi.
Messi's getting forward on the left. He picked out by Iniesta. Here is Messi. Messi into the area, cuts back inside. Twists and turns fantastic from Messi and the cross for Larsson.
He was fast, skillful, and daring. On the opposing side was the Italian champion, Juventus. One of the best defensive teams on the planet still struggled to stop that young lad. I remember the excitement every time Messi had the ball, the sense of possibility. That day, Barcelona fans fell in love with him and rejoiced in what they had witnessed, but especially in what was to come. Playing for Barcelona, Messi became a soccer legend, winning gold trophies at the club level and a record 7 Ballon d'Or, the biggest individual prize in the sport. The story of how Messi left Argentina at age 13 to play for Barcelona is the stuff of legend. One of its protagonists is soccer agent Horacio Gaggioli. I meet with him at a cafe of a tennis club, the very same place where he got Messi his first contract with Barcelona, famously signed on a napkin. Also an Argentine, Gaggioli was very close to Messi during his teen years.
Él pasó tiempos muy malos, la mamá se tuvo que volver a Argentina porque los otros hijos se fueron, se separó la familia.
Messi had a very hard time, he says. His mother went back to Argentina. The family separated. Messi also had to inject his legs every day to treat a growth hormone disorder. Career-wise, though, migrating paid off. Messi joined one of the world's finest soccer academies and grew up surrounded with other great players. His teammates were so good, he says, that they would often serve Messi goals on a platter, so he just had to notch the ball inside the net. But playing for Argentina was a different story. At Barcelona's stadium, I meet Martin Flores, an Argentine soccer fan.
Y por ahí Messi como que nunca se sintió cómodo.
For years, he says, Messi didn't feel comfortable playing for the national team and was heavily criticized. Things have now changed. When he scores for Argentina, he celebrates like when he was at Barcelona. A turning point came last year with the Copa America, his first major trophy with Argentina, which meant he too could lead his country to international glory, like Pelé for Brazil, Cristiano Ronaldo for Portugal, or Maradona, Argentina's last soccer hero. Now, Messi has one last chance to win the biggest trophy of all, and soccer fans from around the world are riveted, like José Alberto Ábalos and Aleida Campos, visiting the Barcelona Stadium from Mexico.
How do you feel being Mexican and being in the same group as Argentina and being being a fan of Messi?
A little bit scary, but I'm excited to see him play.
We share the sentiment with other countries or people that even though our country is against Argentina, I really want Messi to win this World Cup because he deserves it, because football owes Messi this World Cup.
Winning the World Cup with Argentina would make for a perfect redemption story. But great stories don't always have perfect ends, as proven by Messi's own departure from Barcelona a year ago.
Bueno, buen día. La verdad que no sé si voy a poder hablar.
Fighting back tears, he gave a final press conference. Years of mismanagement meant Barcelona could no longer afford to retain the most expensive player in the world. It came as a shock, even for him.
Pero creo que no lo hubiese imaginado de esta manera. Me hubiese gustado hacerlo con gente en el campo.
I would have imagined a different farewell, he said, at the stadium, with a crowd. Messi moved to Paris to play for PSG. And after a difficult year, he is back in great shape just in time for the World Cup. Sports journalist Guillem Balaguer, author of Messi's official biography, says that even if he loses, he will still be the best.
Those that have been born in the last 30 years, 40 years, 50 years even, will think that they haven't seen anything better.
But the story, he says, could still take a last twist.
And then when the next World Cup gets closer, let's see where he is. And let's see if he gets invited to the national side. So this may not be the last World Cup.
For the world, I'm Alan Rusterol in Barcelona.
C Since the overturning of Roe v. Wade in June, there are now a number of states where access to abortion is either banned or severely restricted. But in all those states, there's still an option for those seeking an abortion. It's called Aid Access, a website where a person can order abortion pills from a doctor based in the Netherlands. A study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association earlier this month found a 120% increase in online abortion pill orders from people in the United States. That was during the 2 months following the Supreme Court's decision. Rebecca Gomperts is the Dutch physician and women's rights activist who started Aid Access. She joined us from Amsterdam and spoke with my colleague, Marco Werman.
Dr. Gomperts, how does your website Aid Access actually work? What does a person need to do to have abortion medication sent to them?
It's a system where women go online and they follow the questionnaire that is on the website. There's about 20, 25 questions that the doctors need to be able to judge whether women are eligible for the abortion pills. And I prescribe the medication. The prescription is sent to a pharmacy in India that will fill the prescription, and it will be sent by mail to the women wherever they are. The United States Federal Drug Agency is supporting telemedical abortion care, so abortion care with pills through the mail. It's now officially allowed by the FDA.
So the drugs available from your website are described as physician-supported pills by mail. What does that mean, basically?
So it means that all the questionnaires, all the requests for help that come in, they're reviewed by a doctor and by a specially trained help desk, because this medication is at the moment still only available on prescription.
Doctor, what is the limit in terms of how far along a person can be in their pregnancy in order to get abortion pills?
So the World Health Organization, which is an international organization that is advising governments on anything that concerns health issues, they are supporting home use, self-managed abortions with pills up till 12 weeks of pregnancy. In the United States, the medication is registered for use up till 10 weeks of pregnancy.
Legally, how is Aid Access able to work above the local laws in any particular state?
In most of the states, the women are not criminalized. So women are allowed to have their abortion. It's the people that are helping them or the doctors that are providing it. But these are local state laws. So anybody outside of that state is not covered by those state laws. How I work is that I'm practicing from my Austrian license, so I'm covered by the laws in Austria. And what I do there is following all the medical, ethical, and legal guidelines that exist. So I cannot be charged for providing abortion care to women in other countries.
What if the person, after taking the pills, has some kind of complication and needs medical help? If they're in a state where abortion is illegal, what are their options?
So what we advise them is they can go to a doctor or hospital, but they should say that they had a miscarriage. There's no way that you can distinguish a miscarriage, a spontaneous miscarriage, from an abortion. And this way, people will be safe. The care that the doctors have to provide is exactly the same. And this way, they're protected against any arbitrary legal enforcement or even threat. Worldwide research, and also research in the United States, has shown that it's extremely safe. There's a very little risk of a complication. It's an abortion with pills is very similar to a miscarriage.
Doctor, you started Aid Access in 2018 in the Netherlands, years before Roe v. Wade was overturned. What prompted you to do it?
Well, Aid Access was actually, it's a global service. And this is because we found from other research that there was an incredible demand, especially people that didn't have the money to pay for the local abortion care that was available. Because many abortion clinics, they charge to $600, $700 for an abortion. And 50% of the people in the United States, they live around the poverty threshold, and they don't have $600 or $700 to be able to pay for these kind of unexpected expenses. We started Aid Access more or less as a research project to also understand better what was happening on the ground. We saw a lot of domestic violence cases, a lot of cases of poverty, and then DOPS happened, and then it became clear that it will be continued to be needed.
I'm curious, what do you charge for the abortion pills?
It depends in which states the people are living. In the states where the U.S. providers are serving, they ask for $150. My clients, I ask them $105 US dollars. But if they can't afford to pay, they will also get care, because this is a social justice project and nobody should be denied such an urgent medical care because they cannot afford it.
Dr. Gompertz, why have you devoted your life to providing access to abortion?
Access to a safe abortion is something really fundamental to a person's existence and well-being. If you cannot decide whether or not what is happening with your body and whether or not you're going to have children, there's no way that people have a chance to develop and to plan their own lives and to take charge of their own lives and to control their lives. So I think this is the first fundament that needs to be fulfilled, that people have access to a safe abortion if they need it. And as a woman and as a mother, I know what we want as women is to give everything we have to make sure that our children have a good future and that they will thrive. And if we feel we cannot give that, this is something that we really have to trust and respect.
Dr. Gompertz, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
That's Dr. Rebecca Gompertz, a Dutch physician and a women's rights activist. Her organization, Aid Access, is based in the Netherlands and provides mail-order medication to induce abortions for patients around the globe, including in the U.S. In Azerbaijan, a murder has devastated the Mekana music scene. Mekana is a musical literary tradition dating back to medieval times. Its energy and rhythm is often compared to rap. Fans love it. Critics say the genre glorifies gangs and crime. Last week, one of the country's biggest Mekana artists was arrested after allegedly stabbing and killing an acquaintance. The World's Duri Buscarin has the story.
The Mekana starts with a rhyme. Who the hell are you? Go away. One singer begins in Russian. Then he continues, staying on pace while improvising to the beat. He finishes his turn with the original rhyme. His opponent picks up where he left off, egging him on, getting amped up. Nothing is off the table. Insults, references to drugs and violence, it's all fair game. Switching languages is also encouraged. In this Mekana, recorded at a wedding in 2012 and pulling in 60 million views on YouTube, one participant pulls out verses in Talish, a local minority language. Mekana is often known as the folk rap of Azerbaijan, says Vukar Babazadeh, a pop culture writer based in Baku. The art form dates back to the Middle Ages, Babazadeh explains, when Sufi poets would gather in taverns and recite poetry over bottles of wine. Mekana was banned under the Soviet Union, but continued in private. The wine was replaced by vodka, and the poetry shifted from philosophy to the problems of everyday working people. Taxi drivers, laborers, and people who are intellectuals but still low income, Babazadeh says. After Azerbaijan gained independence in 1991, Mekana went mainstream. Now artists draw massive followings on social media, and almost no one is bigger than Rashad Dalov. Known for his quick responses and poetic phrasing, Dalı has been a mainstay of Mekana TV competitions and daytime shows for years. On November 9th, Dalı shocked the Mekana community. News emerged that he had been arrested on suspicion of stabbing and killing an acquaintance on the outskirts of Baku. The story captivated Azerbaijan. Baku TV reported live from the highway where the stabbing occurred, interviewed the victim's grieving family, as well as supporters of Dalı, who insisted it must have been in self-defense. It was devastating, says Orkan Savalanlı, a pop singer who counts Dalı as one of his inspirations. He's still wrapping his head around the fact that his personal hero may have taken someone's life. On social media, Savalanlı asked Azerbaijan's president to pardon Dalı. Emotionally, we don't want to see someone like him in prison, Savalanlı says. I've always known him as a really good person, and I think most of the Azerbaijani nation thinks so too. Dahlouk was ordered to remain in prison for 4 months as the case continues in Baku. This whole thing needs to be objectively assessed by the legal system, says Ulujay Akif, the editor-in-chief of Kulis AZ, the country's leading arts and culture magazine. He sees Dahlouk's arrest as evidence of a wider problem in the Mekana industry. The Mekana mentality sympathizes with the criminal world, Akif says. This idea that if someone insults you, it's okay to stab him or kill him, Akif says. It spreads in the minds of young people and results in cases like this, he claims. Shaheen, a Mekana fan from Baku, disagrees. He asks only to use his first name due to the risks of criticizing the government there.
You are not listening to Mekana because you are a drug dealer or I know. You just listen to Mekana just to relax.
That's why he thinks Mekana will endure this scandal.
It's kind of the language of the people.
Against all types of tyranny, he says, both social and political. For the world, I'm Dari Buscarin.
In Italy, a new report from the country's Catholic authorities is offering a rare window into the scale of sexual abuse in the church. But survivors say the report is woefully thin on details and is a weak response to a crisis that may still be impacting hundreds of thousands of Italian Catholics. John Last reports from Padua, Italy.
Sono Francesco Zanardi, 52 anni, sono stato abusato.
Francesco Zanardi was just 11 years old when the abuse started, at the hands of a priest relocated to his parish in northern Italy. It wasn't until decades later he discovered the priest had a history of pedophilia. Seeking to bring his abuser to justice, Zanardi founded the organization Rete L'Abuso, together with other survivors of clerical abuse.
In Italia, purtroppo, la legge non è troppo favorevole alle vittime.
But Zanardi says he quickly found the country's laws are not very favorable to victims. Now, with this new report, the church is trying to show how they are reforming that system. Over the past 2 years, the church has been launching listening centers where complaints can be registered and where survivors can be connected with legal and psychological support.
Mi son messo a ridere.
When Zanardi read the results, he says it only made him laugh. The report only covered cases registered in the last 2 years, when the pandemic kept many away from the church. Even still, 89 cases were reported involving 68 abusers, from priests to deacons to local religious teachers. More than half of these were labeled recent, though the report offers no further information on who or what parishes may be involved.
Zanardi
says it's missing data. The 89 cases are likely only a small piece of the picture. It doesn't include reports made through the justice system or his network of survivors. Based on numbers revealed in the French church's inquiry, he estimates since the end of the Second World War, as many as 1 million Italians may have been abused within the church. But many of those cases, including Zanardi's own, will never be examined by church authorities. In their next report, they will only count cases going back to 2001.
20 years is too short.
Massimo Fagioli is an Italian columnist and a professor of Catholic politics at Villanova University. He says Italy's approach is indicative of the country's long-standing reluctance to engage seriously with the problem of clerical abuse.
Italy is years or decades behind other countries.
In France, Germany, Australia, and the United States, he says, independent investigations and truth commissions have uncovered hundreds of thousands of cases of abuse. But Fagioli says in Italy, there's still little appetite in the church for that kind of investigation, and they're not alone.
The national government, the justice system, police, they have no interest till today.
Even the media often minimizes the complaints of activists like Zanardi or fails to cover them altogether. Part of a culture, Fagioli says, that still sees Catholicism as an inseparable part of the Italian state and of Italian identity.
In a sense, Italy is much closer to Catholic cultures in Eastern Europe or in Asia or Africa than North America.
Still, Fagioli sees some reason for hope. At last week's press conference, bishops acknowledged more than 600 cases of abuse have been elevated to Vatican authorities since 2001.
So this is the end of the denial. We don't know the scale, the numbers, but clearly it's no longer sustainable in public that in Italy we don't have this problem.
Fagioli hopes this revelation will drive Italian media, politicians, and society at large to take the issue of clerical abuse more seriously.
Serve solo per rifare lifting alla Chiesa.
But for Survivor Zanardi, the report is nothing more than an attempted facelift for the church. After so many years fighting for justice, he says he's not waiting for the church to fix its own problems.
La Chiesa non può fare niente. Qua deve pensarci lo Stato italiano.
The church can do nothing, he said. This must be the concern of the Italian state. For The World, I'm John Last in Padua, Italy.
The Basque language is spoken in a region of northern Spain and by a smaller number of people just across the border in France. In total, around 750,000 people speak Basque. Its origins, though, are still a big mystery. The language is thought to have been largely a spoken tongue right up until modern times, but a recent archaeological discovery outside of Pamplona in Spain has linguists chattering. Jerry Haddon reports.
They're calling it the Hand of Irulegi, after the ancient settlement where it was unearthed. Archaeologists say it belonged to an Iron Age tribe called the Vascones. It's cut from a thin bronze laminate, and it even has fingernails etched on it, says Javier Velaza. He's a Basque language linguist. Velaza's excited. He's leading an investigation into the find. He says it's intriguing first because archaeologists can date its fate to between 80 and 72 BC. That's when the settlement of Irulegi was caught up in a well-known Roman rebel uprising known as the Sertorian War. The settlement was destroyed, Velaza says. We have evidence of fires there, of homes knocked to the ground, even arrowheads, all these elements of war. And in the ground, right where someone's front door had stood, this hand. The assumption is it once hung on the door. Why? That's the other intriguing thing. There are four lines of writing on the hand in a proto-Basque language. One of the words, Velaza says, is still used today.
Sorion eku.
Sorion eku. It means good fortune or good omen. Velaza says this is solid proof that early Basque was a sophisticated written language more than 2,000 years ago. That's something new. The earliest Basque text known up until now only dates back to the 15th century. Also, Sorioneku is abstract, good fortune. It implies larger forces, something beyond human control. Perhaps Velaza says it was a talisman, hung on a door for luck, protection, or as a desperate Hail Mary as Roman fighters converged on this doomed hamlet.
Lo bonito que tiene la arqueología a veces, que te permite ver y vivir.
That's the beauty of archaeology, he says. You get to relive history in the moment when the settlement was under siege by the enemy, and this hand trying to protect citizens in that moment of anguish, of fear. It's very moving, he says. Moving, but Velaza quickly composes himself. He cautions against giving in to emotion or conjecture. The settlement of Irulegi is still 90% buried, and they've yet to decipher any of the other words on its now famous hand. Archaeology, says Velaza, including linguistic deep digs, take time. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
From a very old discovery to a very large one, a 67-pound goldfish known as the carrot has been caught at a fishery in France. The carrot was a normal-sized goldfish when it was released into a lake 20 years ago, but goldfish can grow as long as their habitat allows. After taking several almost surreal-looking photos holding the massive plump fish, English fisherman Andy Hackett lowered it, and the carrot disappeared back into the green water. This is where we swim away, too. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. See you tomorrow.